This is an ABC podcast.
This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Angus Verley here. Coming up on the Country Hour, it's never you until it is. That's WorkSafe Victoria's message to farmers as part of its ongoing campaign to reduce accidents and fatalities on the land. You'll hear from a farmer who is part of that campaign. And prices for agricultural land have surged recently, but are those prices sustainable? You'll get the thoughts of one leading analyst. And what do those surging prices mean for you? If you're looking to expand, do the numbers add up? Are you able to financially, or are you priced out of the market? You can text in on 0467 842 722. First up today, though, the peak body for the Australian trucking industry says a proposal to increase registration charges on older trucks by up to 220% would be devastating for trucking businesses. The proposal is one of several contained within a report commissioned by AustRoads, a collective of Australian and New Zealand government transport agencies. Australian Trucking Association Chief Executive Andrew McKellar says governments should reject the recommendation immediately.
Well, look, we are deeply concerned by the report, and what we're urging governments around Australia to do is to be very clear that the recommendation that is in this report, which would involve massive increases in truck registration charges, should be ruled out of court immediately. It's completely unrealistic. It would have a massive impact, a massive cost increase for many small truck operators around the country. It would impact really everyone across the sector, including those that are working in rural and regional areas, transporting livestock and goods around the country. It would involve cost increases, registration charges up to $20,000 a year, up to 220% increases. It's completely unrealistic, and it should be ruled out immediately.
So this option or this proposal has a sliding scale, I suppose, for increasing registration for trucks older than manufactured in 2008. What portion of the Australia's fleet would that affect?
Well, look, ultimately, you know, the impact of this could be very significant. We think there could be anywhere up to about 400,000 heavy vehicles impacted, and nearly 150,000 vehicles facing an increase in registration charges of in excess of 200%. That's just really not, it is not realistic. It shouldn't be contemplated. Governments have to be very clear here. This sort of thing should not be on the agenda at all. It shouldn't be put into print like this. We need to look at other options. And we have seen more positive options in the recent past. I mean, for example, the instant asset write-off provisions that have been put in place in response to the COVID pandemic, these have been extremely helpful. We've seen many fleet operators able to invest in new capital, in buying new vehicles, getting safer vehicles, more environmentally friendly vehicles on the roads. And that's been extremely successful. So if anything, what we should be doing is we should be contemplating how we extend those provisions or how we ensure that those are flexible for a little bit longer so that when people are taking possession of a new vehicle beyond the 30th of June next year, that they are able to continue to have access to those write-off arrangements.
The report does say that trucks in Australia and New Zealand are older than comparable countries, and that leads to issues with things like higher levels of air pollution and less safety. Does Australia have an issue with an ageing trucking fleet?
Well, look, I think it's certainly true that there are many older vehicles that are still part of the national fleet. And, of course, we have to think about how is it that we encourage operators to take up newer vehicles, safer vehicles that have better emissions performance, But this is not the way to do it. There are many positive things that can be done to help bring newer vehicles into the vehicle fleet. And as I say, things like the instant asset write-off or the accelerated asset write-off, these have been successful strategies. They've certainly helped in the last 12 months. But the idea that we go and slug registration charges by these sorts of amounts at a time when the industry has been responding, it's been supporting critical needs within the economy, keeping goods on the supermarket shelves, getting the livestock to markets, all of these things, to suggest that at that sort of time, the response to that sort of effort, we could contemplate hitting small operators, including farm operators, with these sorts of increases in registration charges. You know, governments just need to be very clear. This is not on the cards, not for a second.
Andrew, you mentioned farmers there, and it's maybe not explicit in the report from my reading of it, but would these changes apply to those with primary producer registration?
Well, I mean, I think that's for the authors of the report and for governments to be clear about, because, you know, if you're paying registration charges on your truck, on your vehicle, and it's over a certain age, then one would assume that to be effective, what this report is suggesting, it will apply to everybody.
An increase in registration charges isn't the only policy that this report recommends. It also identifies two others, which are some form of road user charging and also road access restrictions for older trucks. What do you think of those other two?
Well, look, I think, again, we've got to be extremely careful. You know, reform of road user charging is something that needs to be on the national agenda. We need to come up with a better, more sustainable model that links, you know, the demand that we have for critical road infrastructure and the road network and how that is paid for, because the current model is broken and it needs to be fixed, and we need to come up with something where there's a fair allocation of the costs. That's part of a bigger equation. Access restrictions, again, you know, this should not be driven on the basis of the age of the vehicle. I think we've got to be very careful about how we end up prescribing solutions here that will end up just making it more difficult for people to do business and to get the goods to the place where they need to be.
Just finally, Andrew, this is only an increase in registration charges is only one proposal contained within a research report. If it was ultimately to be enforced, what would it mean for the industry?
If this sort of suggestion came forward, then I think what you'd see is very, very significant cost increases. Many operators in the industry are not in the position to pass those increases on. The result would be that we would see significant financial difficulties for many small operators in the industry. We've got to come up with a better solution, one which is much more positive and encourages operators to invest in new vehicles in a positive way, not one that penalises people for the situation that they find themselves in. So I think from that point of view, governments have really got to say that this research report hasn't hit the mark. I'm surprised that it's gone out in the form that it has. And we think that it's back to the drawing board with this.
That was Australian Trucking Association Chief Executive Andrew McCullough. And what would that mean for you if you are running an older model truck? An increase of 220% on your registration. You can text in 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It's never you until it is. That's WorkSafe Victoria's message to farmers in its campaign to reduce accidents and fatalities on farms. Agriculture remains one of the state's most dangerous industries, with 24 people dying as a result of on-farm workplace incidents just in the past 3 years. And last year alone, 424 people working in agriculture were injured seriously enough to make a workers' compensation claim. BEAC farmer Tom Alston was in a motorbike accident in 2008, and he says it changed his attitudes towards farm safety.
No, I was riding across a bridge on the farm, a concrete bridge, and it had been raining. It was quite wet and just human error. I just yeah, just fell off, hit a wet patch on the bridge and went skidding up the bitumen and then onto the gravel and ended up all wrapped up in a fence at the other end. So it wasn't much fun.
So what injuries came from that accident?
Oh, just no broken bones or anything, just a lot of skin off right down my side and hips and elbows and shoulders and stuff. Luckily I had a helmet and that on, but it wasn't much good.
Was that just sort of a normal everyday activity for you before the accident?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I ride motorbikes a lot. I've raced motorbikes and ridden motorbikes since I was a little kid on the farm. And it's a pretty, day-to-day thing for me, riding motorbikes. But you always learn from your mistakes and, try not to do those sort of silly things twice.
When your family found out what happened, how did they react?
Well, they were shocked and pleased to know that I was all right, but, they weren't overly impressed about the whole situation, no.
Has that made you change the way that you act on farm now and some of the safety precautions that you maybe didn't take before?
Well, I don't want to go through it again, that's for sure. So I always make sure I've got the correct, protective clothing on when I'm on the motorbike, because I'm not going to do that again. And maybe a good lesson is just slow down a bit.
You've joined the WorkSafe campaign around farm safety. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, join WorkSafe, it's a good thing to be involved in, I think. We've got quite a good relationship with Glenn Woods, who is our WorkSafe man on the farm here. He comes out, we have a chat about a few things from time to time and have a look over, procedures, what we're doing on the farm and see if we can make anything better. Anything we can do for safety for ourselves and people coming onto the farm, I think, is a pretty big priority, really. Like, it's pretty easy to get injured out here, so anything we can do to keep people a bit safer is well worth looking into.
The WorkSafe campaign's called It's Never You Until It Is. Did you feel a bit bulletproof before this happened?
When you're younger, I think everyone feels pretty bulletproof. As I said, I'd race bikes and stuff and never had two bigger accidents because I suppose you got that much safety gear on in those scenarios. And, of course, I thought I was bulletproof. But, it was a bit of a wake-up call when I had that, yeah.
So, Tom, since your accident, has your family now also started to be a little bit more cautious on farm and take farm safety a bit more seriously?
Yeah, safety, it's a funny thing. The older generation, safety was never as big an issue. There's a lot of the old comments, she'll be right. There's a lot of people hurt and injured. But it doesn't, especially, working with your family and stuff, you don't want to see anyone get hurt. So anything you can do, just simple things. Like putting helmets on motorbikes and rollover protection and trying not to ride like you're on the racetrack and that sort of thing, and correct training and safety gear, that sort of stuff. It all comes with it. And I think it was a bit of an eye-opener the day I had that big accident to just make sure you are doing all those things, really, yeah.
So in addition to improving general safety, you've also implemented drones as part of your operations. How does that work?
Yes. Well, our farm's very undulated, very rocky and scrubby. And we grew up on horseback. That was just the way it was done. And then my brother and I got good enough on motorbikes to be able to get over all the stones and stuff on motorbikes, but it was still time consuming and pretty dangerous, really. And no one else could help us because it was just too hard to try and expect staff to be able to do those sort of things. So we came up with the idea a few years ago of using drones and looked into it a bit. They were using them over in New Zealand with really good success. So we thought we'd have a go, and it's been unbelievable. It works. The sheep, especially, and the cattle, they both respond to the drone extremely well. You can move the stock without stressing them at all. You can move them at their own pace and cover the paddock with ease. If I crash the drone, well, I'll just go and buy another one. I don't have to, go to the hospital, that's for sure.
And just finally, Tom, your family's been farming in the Beac region in southwest Victoria for a while now. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the farm?
Dad bought this farm when he was younger, and him and his brother, I think he was only 21 at that stage, and they farmed it together and then went their separate ways. So mum and dad just kept farming and had four boys, and two of us have ended up back on the farm, and The other two are off doing their own thing. And, yeah, we just sort of work together. And Bill, my brother, and I have taken over the farm now from Mum and Dad. They want to retire, but I don't think they ever will. They're still pretty involved around the place. But, yeah, my brother and I have taken it over and sort of pushing it forward into the future now.
That was Managing Director at Stonyhurst Pastoral, Tom Alston, speaking with Jane McNaughton. A text from Doug on our previous story about this proposal to increase registration for older trucks, increase of up to 220%. Doug says, what about using the fuel tax that we already pay, around 70% of $1.35? At the moment, with what we already pay for the roads, and they're still pretty ordinary, he's thinking that the fuel tax doesn't get used on the roads. You can text in 0467 842 722. It's 20 past 12. You're listening to The Country Hour with Angus Verley. Well, it's no secret that land prices are rising quickly, and particularly in those grain-growing regions. But the question is, are those price rises sustainable? Well, data from ABARES shows that 2020 was the sixth straight year for land price growth, which equates to a 41% rise nationally over that period. I spoke with Rabobank's Wes Lefroy about what's driving the increases and what prospect there is of a downward correction.
We really drilled into crop land prices in particular, and we ran a statistical model, a regression model, and the three key variables that came back as the key drivers for land prices was firstly interest rates. The second one was productivity, being output and costs. And the third one as well was commodity prices. So these three variables actually explained about 87% of the movement of land prices, with other factors such as lifestyle factors making up the remainder. So those three factors really are the core drivers of land prices over the last 30 years.
So, Wes, that's, I suppose, an explanation of what's happening and why it's happening. But there is this big question that we keep hearing asked, and it is, are those land prices sustainable? What's your response to that question?
So while the price growth has been sharp and also strong, we do expect that prices are sustainable at these levels, with a downward correction very unlikely. And the main reason for that, if we come back to the performance of those three fundamentals that I mentioned there, they've remained extremely strong. So for example, we've seen interest rates declining, particularly over the last 4 to 5 years, which has increased purchasing power. But we've also seen relatively strong grain prices, and we've also seen strong production, particularly over the last 5 years as well. So those three factors in particular have been extremely supportive of land prices and have really driven the growth.
But there does seem to be a consensus that land prices or land price increases have grown faster than productivity has increased. So doesn't that imply that land is actually now overvalued?
Yeah, it can imply it from a purely mathematical sense, but it's important to recognise here that the pure returns aren't the only reason for buying. So, for example, in some regions in particular, we've actually seen many large farmers who perhaps border each other are actually willing to pay a premium, which can be up to 20 to 40% higher than the market, just to purely unlock economies of scale. So depending on who is buying, where they're buying, some farmers can actually, you know, warrant to pay a premium on some areas of land. And then also, depending on the concentration of those types of farmers, we can actually see some regions moving up faster than others according to its productivity.
And Wes, just returning to that prospect of a price correction, what would it take for there to be a price correction, and how likely would it be for those circumstances to emerge?
So in the past, when we've seen a decrease in land prices, we have seen at least two of those factors that I mentioned earlier of interest rates, productivity and commodity prices actually be unsupportive or be a negative shock. So over the next 12 months, we certainly don't foresee that happening. But moving forward, if we were to see for example, a widespread drought across the country, or we were to see grain prices across the country fall significantly as well, then the combination of those two we see could potentially bring a downward correction in land prices. But just to reiterate, we certainly don't see that happening in the next 12 months. But for a downward correction to happen, we would need to see a combination of those factors being unsupported to land price markets.
And if we did ultimately see a correction, do you think it would be more like a flatlining of prices rather than a sharp decline?
So typically within land markets, we don't see a sharp downward correction. We typically see a downward adjustment or a slow adjustment over a matter of 2 to 3 to 4 years. And the reason for that in particular is if there is a significant shock to agriculture or the broader economy that impacts agriculture, then farmers typically don't tend to sell their farms. So the supply side or the number of properties on the market can actually be quite controlled. And particularly during the drought period that we saw in the eastern states, this was one of the key factors that helped supporting prices through that period, was that we saw a real contraction in supply. So while demand had fallen significantly during the drought, it still actually outweighed supply just because supply was so tight.
So, Wes, it seems that the answer to the question of are high ag land prices sustainable is generally yes, but do you think we should also acknowledge that every individual farmer's financial position and financial capacity is different, and then that they shouldn't be looking at some of these high land prices and saying, well, we need to go and extend ourselves and pay those prices because that's what other people are paying?
Absolutely. And I think it's important to understand that every single farmer's circumstances are completely different in terms of their expansion strategies, their financial position, where they're at in terms of their career as well. So they should be making those decisions according to those different circumstances.
That was Wes Lefroy, Senior Agricultural Analyst at Rabobank.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, there's some big news out this week for Australia's citrus industry, with confirmation that citrus canker has been eradicated from the Northern Territory. The plant disease, which infamously wiped out millions of dollars worth of crop in Emerald, Queensland, back in 2004, was found in the NT back in April 2018. Dr. Anne Walters is the Territory's Chief Plant Health Officer. She says it's taken a lot of work to achieve eradication.
Yeah, it's been a huge effort. So we've nearly been 3 years in getting to this point. So from detection, we obviously had to put in a response program and a control centre for us to fight citrus canker, basically, to go out to plant all the properties that we could and find as many of the infected plants as we possibly could, destroy the plants that we did find that were infected and monitor those that weren't infected over a long period of time. And after 2 years of us doing surveillance and looking for citrus canker, we've finally been able to say that we're 99.99% confident that we've eradicated it from the Northern Territory.
And so this declaration today, what does it mean for citrus growers?
So what it means for our local citrus growers is that some of the restrictions that were put in place with citrus canker, which has meant increased inspections of fruit and product, as well as treatment of their fruit, it no longer needs to be in place, following a few little things that we need to obviously work out with other jurisdictions to make sure that we meet their requirements. But essentially it means that, subject to those requirements being lifted by the other jurisdictions, which we're hoping to happen very quickly, they will no longer have to implement those additional treatments and inspections, which obviously reduces costs and time, which is really critical for our local growers. In terms of national growers, it's really critical, because Australia being able to say that we're free from citrus canker means that that nationally all of our growers can demand a more premium price for our product, because we don't have this disease, and so other countries are more likely to want to import our fruit and pay more for it.
During this period, these last 3 years, has this been costly to Australia's citrus industry? Have we lost markets?
No, we've been fortunate that we've been able to contain the eradication program and the disease to the Northern Territory. It was detected initially in Western Australia, but the Western Australian government got rid of citrus canker very quickly. They only had a very small number of plants infected. It's been a much larger program in the Northern Territory. But because we've been able to contain it and we stopped fruit and plants from moving from the territory once we detected it very quickly, we were able to contain it and therefore prevent the spread and impacts that could happen because of that.
So in the end, how bad was the citrus canker outbreak in the Northern Territory in terms of the number of plants affected and businesses affected?
Well, we were fortunate that I think we got on top of it very quickly. We detected it quite early and we were able to stop it from spreading. So in terms of the numbers of actual infected plants, it was quite low. So outside of where the disease was first detected, we only found about 16 properties that were infected, which is really small, but also meant that it created a lot of challenges with trying to find where the infected products and plants might be. So we were fortunate. We got on top of it really early. We had a great team behind us. We had industry behind us and the community was really supportive, and we were very fortunate to be able to hit it hard and hit it quickly.
It all started at a top-end nursery. Did you ever work out how it got there?
No, we've never been able to find out how it got there. We've done quite a lot of investigation into where it may have come from, and we haven't been able to work that out.
That was Northern Territory Chief Plant Health Officer Dr. Anne Walters speaking to Matt Brann. Well, it's just gone 29 minutes to one, so that does mean we need to get off to news headlines today with Alexander Darling.
Good afternoon, Angus. Police are continuing the search for a 54-year-old New South Wales man who disappeared from his campsite in Victoria's Far East on Saturday morning. Christopher Fowle was last seen at a logging protest camp near Bendoc. Protesters, logging security contractors, Mounted Police and Mr. Fowle's family are all searching for him. In Bendigo, a man has been taken to hospital in a serious condition with burns to his upper body after an industrial accident. It happened at a Golden Square business before 9 o'clock. In the state's west, police want to talk to the occupants of a dark grey Mitsubishi Triton seen in the vicinity of a hayshed fire in St Arnold. Inspector Paul Lloyd has told the ABC the fire, which flared up on Sunday morning, burned through more than 8,000 bales of hay at Gilmack Processing Plant, causing $1 million in damage. Inspector Lloyd says arson chemists are expecting the fire site after the flames were extinguished this morning. A national environmental advocacy group says wild weather in Port Fairy in the state's southwest coast on the weekend could be a sign of things to come. Friends of the Earth says the rough seas which caused destruction to several sites in the southwest is linked to sea level rises as a result of climate change. Elsewhere, a Koroit Wildlife Centre is pleading with people to keep an eye out for stranded wildlife along the region's beaches after several penguins stranded by the weather were rescued near Warrnambool. It's been revealed the Victorian government's prescription drug trafficking program is failing to help people addicted to medications because it doesn't collect information about those identified as being at risk. Documents obtained by the ABC through Freedom of Information reveal almost $30 million program doesn't collect information about what happens to patients who access a large number of prescription medications. The Victorian Drug and Alcohol Foundation says it's seeing some patients cut off their medication, prompting them to buy on the black market. And Macedon Rangers author John Marsden says he's overwhelmed after receiving an honorary doctorate from the University of the Sunshine Coast. The award recognises Mr. Marsden's contribution to Australian literature and education. His Tomorrow When the War Began series of novels for young adults has become key literature in schools across Australia and the world, as well as a popular film and television show. And just quickly, Angus, there were no new COVID cases in Victoria overnight. There are 3 active cases statewide, all in hotel quarantine, and almost 2,500 vaccines, I should say, administered yesterday.
Good news. Thanks, Alex. Alex Darling there with news headlines. Well, off to the Weather Bureau now, where senior forecaster Michael Efron is on duty. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon, Angus.
Michael, quite a fresh day again today.
That's right, strengthening northerly winds across the state at the moment, and we have issued a severe weather warning for potentially damaging winds for elevated parts of the state, so mainly across the Great Divide and also down through the Otways as well. So we're seeing gusts at the moment generally around the 50 to 60 kilometre an hour mark, but across the Grampians around 11:30 this morning. We saw gusts around 85 kilometres an hour. So those winds are picking up from the west ahead of a cold front which will cross the state during Wednesday. But for the rest of today, we are seeing high cloud increasing as well from the west, and also some light shower activity as well. We are seeing some echoes on the radar, but with some pretty dry air closer to the surface, a lot of that is evaporating before it reaches the ground. So not much in that. And in terms of temperatures for the rest of today, a fairly mild day through the north, hitting the low 20s there, 22 at Swan Hill, 21 at Echuca. And across the south of the state, looking at the high teens or low 20s, 19 at Sale today, 16 for Ballarat, 19 at Wangaratta. And up through the northwest of the state, we could actually see some dust with those strong winds around today. But during Wednesday, we will see that front crossing the state, as I mentioned earlier, and we'll see those strong and gusty northerly winds across central parts and eastern parts of the state during the early morning, but they'll ease as we head into the afternoon. The winds will go around to the west. We'll have just some isolated showers, mainly affecting southern and mountain districts. In terms of temperatures, still reasonably mild, hitting the high teens in the south, low to mid-20s through the north, and with that shower activity, we're not expecting any significant totals. So as we push into Thursday, we do see generally partly cloudy conditions across the state. Some showers expected down to the southwest, and in terms of temperatures, with westerly winds, we're looking at the high teens in the south again, low 20s through the north. And then on Friday, we'll have some showers around across the south, most likely in the morning, but dry conditions expected through the north. And temperature-wise, we're looking at the mid-teens in the south, high teens to low 20s across the northern parts. And then through the weekend, we're not going to see too much change in the pattern with west to south-westerly winds. Isolated showers affecting southern parts, dry conditions through the north, some cool mornings for the north as well, temperatures around 3 to 6 degrees there. And then in terms of afternoon temperatures, hitting the low 20s across the north, and in the south we're looking at the mid to high teens. And then pushing into early next week, I think we'll see those westerly winds continuing. So not much change, isolated showers still affecting southern parts, dry conditions through the north, and again temperatures in the low 20s across the north, high teens in the south. So unfortunately there's not much rain in the outlook, especially for those northern parts, which are really looking at that rain given the time of year and looking at sowing. So unfortunately not much there in the outlook.
So virtually nothing really to speak of.
Pretty much a dry week for those northern districts, and even in the south, not expecting too much either.
Okay, no worries. Thanks for that, Michael.
Thanks, Angus.
That was Michael Efron, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau. Well, have a look at the text line. Plenty of people texting in on our earlier story about this proposal to increase registration on older trucks starting from 2008. And older from date of manufacture, increases of up to 220%. Well, a couple of really pertinent texts. Mick Courtney's text in. He says, "My wife and I own a small transport company in East Gippsland, carting water, livestock, hay and machinery. We own three trucks, one prime mover and two tray trucks. All our trucks are older trucks. If this proposal goes ahead, we will be forced to close our business down. We cannot afford to update our entire fleet, and nobody will want to buy our old trucks. This will kill the price of old equipment." Thanks for that text there, Mick. And you can text in 0467 842 722.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
Wool industry leaders are calling for the submission period for the Australian Wool Exchange's review of the National Wool Declaration to be extended, so that the results of a University of Melbourne study into the freeze branding alternative to traditional mulesing can be considered. The submission period closed on April 6, and that's despite the results of that study into the relative pain of freeze branding not being released. Josh Lamb, president of the Australian Council of Wool Exporters and Processors, says the review will be hollow without the results of that study.
The primary reason for having another review only 12 months after we had the last one was to consider the benefits, so to speak, of freeze branding and liquid nitrogen, and that was all to be based off a trial that the University of Melbourne did. Unfortunately, the submission date closed before the official report or findings had been released on that trial, which is a bit disappointing. There have been preliminary findings out in the industry since December, but that hasn't been made available to everyone, to all stakeholders. So it's been very hard to make a definitive submission from individuals and from associations on how they'd like that liquid nitrogen to be considered.
So you'd like the submission period to be extended or be reopened once this University of Melbourne report into those pain levels of freeze branding is released, so that people can consider that report and then update their submissions?
Yeah, very much so. Apparently the final report's not far away. I don't think it's weeks, it might only be days, but the deadline has cut off. But we can't see any huge ramifications to extending that or reopening that deadline by AWACS to a later date, even if it's just a few weeks' time, because we need to have everything available to us to make correct submissions. And the NWD's the document that the industry wants to use to support welfare practices and sustainability, and we need it to be right for the long term. So another few weeks is certainly not going to be the end of the world if we could get that deadline extended. The whole primary reason for this review we're having at the moment that's already been closed off was for liquid nitrogen and freeze branding. So AWACS had decided to close it off and go ahead anyway, even without the correct information being put out there. So all seems a bit strange to me.
And the preliminary results from the University of Melbourne report, they apparently conclude that freeze branding with meloxicam pain relief is similarly painful to mulesing with meloxicam, using the traditional method of mulesing. How do you think that information would be received by industry, and how would it affect people's submissions?
Well, essentially what they're saying, it's no improvement on the mulesing practice we have or the current way sheep and mules at the moment, which is disappointing because we do want the industry to move forward with mulesing or you know, the reduction in the amount of mulesing that goes on. The long-term solution for mulesing obviously lies in genetics, and we've seen that happen already over the last 20 years. Yeah, look, it's we've been told this is what's come out of the preliminary report, but again, we haven't seen it.
So maybe you can't answer this then, Josh, but based on those preliminary results, how do you believe that freeze branding should be categorised? Should it be in that mulesed category, that non-mulesed category, or in its own category?
Well, we're being told from customers overseas, and ultimately these things, how they're categorised is a direct result of how consumers interpret them, which means then our customers let us know how these things need to sit within the industry. And at the moment, we're certainly being told that it does not fit in the non-mules category. Therefore, it has to go into the mules category. I don't think we want categories upon categories on the NWD, which makes it more confusing. What we want to see is the non-mules part of the wool clip being treated as it should be, which is above all else, and maintaining its integrity.
So what would be the flow-on effects, I suppose, for the way that Australian wool is perceived in that global market if freeze branding was categorised as non-mulesed, I suppose, if the status quo was maintained, because that is currently the way that it's categorised?
That is the way it's categorised at the moment. There was a fair bit of panic about 12 months ago to have it categorised that way, which in hindsight's led us to where we are now, which has turned into a little bit of a mess over it. So I think at this stage, the customers that we're talking to want it categorised as mules because you're still altering the breech of the sheep. And there's plenty of arguments around the definitions of mulesing, but that's how it sits at the moment.
So what does that then mean for the future of freeze branding if it was to be recategorised as mulesed?
Well, I don't think it's not the end of the world for freeze branding. I think it'd be a good idea if it did sit in the mulesing category. Let's give it 4 or 5 or 6 years. Let's get a bit more science on it and a bit more data, and let's give customers further down the chain overseas a chance to actually learn more about it, find out perhaps maybe it can sit in an on-mules category one day, but as it stands today, it can't do that. But it needs time to find its place in the marketplace, and that hasn't happened.
And just returning to the National Wool Declaration Review, Josh, which is now closed without people being able to consider this report into how painful freeze branding is, Do you think that that NWD review is going to be useful? Is it actually going to reflect what people think if they haven't been able to consider that University of Melbourne data?
There'll be other things considered with the NWD, but I do think it makes it a little bit hollow as a review when we can't actually consider all the facts as they stand at the moment. So the review will still go ahead. There are other things that people may want changed on the NWD. Freeze branding's just part of it. But, yeah, it does make it a little bit hollow, I think.
That was Josh Lamb, Trading Manager with Endeavour Wool Exports and President of the Australian Council of Wool Exporters and Processors. And I did contact the Australian Wool Exchange this morning, and Chief Executive Mark Graves said that those calls for an extension to the submission period had been received, considered and declined.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
To the olive industry now, where harvest is well underway near Swan Hill. Gary Chastney is an olive oil and table olive producer at Tresco, and he says after losing his fruit to wind last year, he's relieved to see a healthy-looking crop.
Really good this year, and we've got a bumper table olive crop. Not too many on the oil trees, but we've got a lot of varieties that are both table and an oil olive, so we can use table olives for oil. So we're looking at a very good year this year.
So what varieties do you have?
So we've got Frantoio, which is oil. Manzanillo is table and oil. Spanish Queen is a big table olive. And Jumbo Calamata is a big jumbo olive.
What sort of factors in the growing season do you think contributed to a healthy-looking crop?
I think it was the reduced temperatures. Obviously, there's a lot more groundwater that's been around this year. Quite strange, though, is the fact that it's a really early harvest this year. We're normally not starting the harvest until sort of towards the beginning of May, June, and then rushing to beat the frosts. So we actually started harvesting the table olives about a month ago, and the majority are green at the moment, starting to turn black. So it's a really early harvest for us this year.
And do you know what caused that?
Not too sure, really. Last year, we didn't have a crop at all. We lost all of our flowers in September in the winds. And the higher price of water. So probably I would say, you know, the table olives have had a lot more growth through the last winter and spring season. So the olives grow on the last year's new growth, which is just abundant on the trees this year, more of the table olives than the oil.
So you missed out on a crop last year, but how would you compare this year's crop so far to others gone by?
This is our biggest by far.
And like you said, you're going to be on a bit of a strict timeline with picking to avoid the frost, but given that earlier harvest, you think that won't be an issue for you at all?
It shouldn't be at all. We're already booked in with the processors for next month, so we're a month ahead. I don't think, barring any issues or problems, we'll beat the frosts this year and get a full harvest in.
How much fruit are you expecting from your farm?
Again, with the oil, it's hard to tell on the percentage, whether we're going to go somewhere between 23 and 26% on the oil olives. So we could end up with, you know, roughly 2,000 to 4,000 litres on oil. And table olives, I'm estimating whether we actually get them all off the tree before they start to fall off, where they've ripened completely. I'm estimating we'll probably end up with around five to six tons of table olives.
Yeah. You've been in the industry since 2017 when you literally sort of stumbled onto the Grove while looking for the property as a part of a move from Tasmania. How's the experience been so far?
Yeah, look, it's been a big learning curve. Obviously, we're both English and we haven't come from a farming background, so we've had to learn the whole farm life and how it all works from scratch. We've got some really good friends who process for us in Bort, and they've been fantastic with all the help and advice that they've given us. They've had a grow for about the last 20 years. So it's, you know, and the previous owner was very helpful. But, yeah, it's lots of courses, lots of studying, and then actually getting in and keeping the grow going and processing and providing a future for the family.
You sell your products locally in the Swan Hill area and also online. Are there plans to increase your scale or diversify your farm at all?
Yes. So we're planning to branch out to have distributors in Sydney, Adelaide and Brisbane later on this year.
That was Gary Chastney from Chastney Estate speaking with Alex Treloar. It's 10 minutes to one. You're listening to The Country Hour with Angus Furley. Well, they say never let a fox into the hen house, but how about a dog? That's what Mount Roland free-range egg farmer Phil Glover did 5 years ago when he introduced a Maremma to his property in northwest Tasmania. The breed is fiercely loyal and protective of its flock, living alongside the chickens, protecting them from predators.
Yeah, was having significant eagle problems. I started sort of looking in the mainland to where we could get one, and we managed to get one, which is this one here, Boss. He's the first one we got. He's 5 years old. We trialled him and, yeah, proved quite successful, so we acquired a female and we've been breeding some pups out of him ever since. Currently have five. Probably could do with a couple more. We sell quite a few pups. There's a pretty good demand out there for them, not just for free-range poultry, but sold to a couple of people who's got goat farms, mainly smallholders, like hobby farmers that are, yeah, keep trying to keep wallabies and possums out of fruit trees and gardens and that. They're pretty good at that. Anything that's not part of their normal environment, they perceive as a threat, so they become quite aggressive with. Yeah, they're very territorial and very, very defensive of their environment, and they're very, very tuned into anything that's out of the ordinary. Yeah, they are very active at night. They bark a lot at night. Yeah, wouldn't be ideal in the backyard in town. They'd be keeping people up. You'd have a lot of irate neighbours.
What's the purpose of having the dogs here?
The main purpose of the dogs is to protect from predators. Our main predators are eagles, and our secondary predators are quolls. Stray dogs can be a problem. The dogs are very, very protective of, yeah, they're very aggressive with anything that's like the eagles, quolls, stray dogs, yeah.
And especially chooks, I mean, it's quite easy for them to be, you know, picked off by a predator.
It is, yeah, that's yeah, they're pretty vulnerable chooks, but the dogs are just on guard all the time, 24 hours a day. We never take the dogs away from the actual flocks of chooks. We've never, to date, we haven't lost any of our chooks to predators while we've had dogs with them.
Certainly earning their keep, eh?
For sure, yeah. We're not 100% on this, but we've noticed, like, not long after we got the dogs, our production went up a bit, and I put that down to probably minimising the stress from the eagles. That's probably helped that, yeah. Because when chooks get stressed, you'll get quite a few funny-shaped and odd-looking eggs, and that's a sign of stress. Well, we don't seem to see as many of those either, and that's coincided pretty much with the interaction of the dogs.
How do they relate to the dogs? Because typically dogs and chooks don't mix. In fact, you would have thought they'd be running as soon as they see a four-legged creature in their paddock?
I think these hybrid layers, these high lines, which everybody calls eyes of rounds, are quite inquisitive chooks, and I think they're not feeling too threatened by the chooks. We gradually introduce them. The chooks probably don't really see the dogs till they're about 10 weeks old, and then we have the dogs are locked outside beside the chooks, so it's a bit of a gradual introduction, because if we let the dogs straight in with the chooks, the dogs would probably go in with the sheds, frighten the chooks, and they'd probably, you know, we'd have quite a few get smothered because they do panic a bit at times. But once they're comfortable with the dogs, they just bond well. They're just like mates. The chooks, you know, they just get all over. They groom the dogs. Like, the dogs will just lay down up the paddock and the chooks will groom them. They
enjoy that. They don't.
They do. Yep. I'll be surprised if you don't leave here. Before you leave here, you see it happening. It's just like, yeah, they just peck through the dog's fur. And, yeah, the dogs seem to enjoy it. So it's quite a symbiotic relationship, really. The dogs get groomed and a bit of attention from the chooks, and the chooks get protected, so... And the dogs are handy too in the sheds. They go around the sheds and we get a few floor eggs. They'll go around, they'll nose through the eggs on the floor till they find the crack ones, and they eat the crack ones. So that's helpful for us. It's ones we don't have to worry about looking for.
Tips of the job.
Fringe benefits, yeah.
That was free-range egg producer Phil Glover speaking to Lachlan Bennett about his Maremma dogs. Well, a couple of texts there on our story about whether there should be an extension to the submission period for the review of the National Wool Declaration. Andrew at Edenhope says, of course the time for submissions should be extended as that Melbourne University report is only days away. He says, Freeze branding is not mulesing, as there is no blood and there is no cutting involved. And he says genetics is still an illusion over the horizon. Meanwhile, people need to accept a process which meets all rational concerns. And Helen from Central Gippsland, the only reason sheep are mulesed is to prevent fly strike. If a vaccination against fly strike was developed, farmers would never need to mules again. The genome of this species was mapped in the 1990s. Why no vaccination yet? Interesting one. Thanks for your text there, Alan. Well, off to the markets now, starting today at Wodonga Cattle with Leanne Dax.
Numbers lifted to 1,050. Quality was quite mixed with some well-bred steers and heifers to suit lot feeders. These lines sold strongly. Trade cattle were in shorter supply and the well-finished stock sold at a buoyant bidding. Heavy export cattle were also in limited number and quality was quite good. The pick of the veal were 15 cent steerer, $4.46 to $5.06. Trade steers were three better, $4 to $5.15. Feeder steers, medium weights were firm, $3.92 to $4.65. The lighter weights out to $4.75. Feeder heifer prices were erratic depending on breed and colour. Despite this, prices bounced 15 cents, $3.70 to $4.60. Trade heifers were back 12, $3.71 to $4.92. Grown steers were firm to four easier, $3.48 to $4.22. And bullocks were unchanged, $3.72 to $3.99. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Shepherd and Cattle now with Nicole Varley.
Good afternoon. Well, we had 800 exports and 400 trade cattle pen. All buyers were back on the rails and competition was buoyant across the cow grades and trade cattle. The tightening numbers pushed cow prices higher. However, quality deteriorated significantly this week, particularly in the trade section. The grown steers had weight but lacked the finish. Trade cattle were of mixed breeds with more dairy or Bos Indicus infusion and were underdone and didn't meet the grade for most of the meat buyers. The medium and heavy weighted vealers ranged from 430 to 509 to the trade. The yearling steers were the big movers of the day, 15 to 25 cents steerer on the better end and made from 420 to 48 cents to average 470. Young steers to the feedlots made to 496. Yearling heifers to processors $4 to 463 with numbers and quality very limited. Grown steers 500 to 600 kilos, 345 to 397, to average 383. They sold to cheaper rates due to the leanness. 600 kilo plus bullocks made from 366 to 397, to average 386. Dairy cows 3 to 6 cents higher, beef cows 3 to 11 cents dearer. Beef cows making from 306 to 335, averaging 322 for the D4s, and the dairy cows 210 to 295, with the D1s averaging 254. This is Nicole Varley from Shepparton.
Thanks to Cole, and finally to Ballarat Lambs with Tim Delaney.
Good afternoon, Angus. Lamb numbers lifted with a close to 39,000 drawford, which was 9,000 head more at Ballarat. Quality varied from average to very good, with a mix of well-presented heavy export lambs to plain unfinished lambs offered. Usual buy and go were present. They operated in overall cheaper markets for the sale, with the heavy and tray weight lambs. The light lambs, however, sold mostly from firm to $2 dearer, benefiting from the extra competition restockers. Tray weights were from $5 to $6 easier, with the heavy and extra heavy lambs from $6 to $12 cheaper. At this stage, there's still 8,000 lambs still to be sold. As the prices reached the top of $305, restockers purchased light lambs from $106 to $121, and well-bred store lambs from $131 to $184. Lightweight lambs sold from $116 to $149, averaging between $885 to $900. Light tray weight lambs sold from $138 to $173, and medium tray weight lambs from $168 to $188. Heavier tray weight sold from $177 to $195. The extra heavier tray weight lambs made between $192 to $206, averaging from $780 to $800 a kilogram carcass weight. Heavier 27 to 30 kilogram carcass weight lambs sold from $205 to $242. Extra heavy export lambs made from $238 to $305. Merino lambs made from $149 to $180, to average $7.10. Heavy crossbred hoggers sold to $204. 14,600 sheep drawn for yet to be sold. Tim Delaney reports at MLA Ballarat.
Thank you, Tim. Well, that's all for markets today. Time now to have a quick look at some of your texts, and quite a few there coming through on this proposal to increase registration costs for older trucks, older than 2008. Two sides of the coin here, I reckon. One texter says, I think that if a car or a truck is over 25 years old, They shouldn't be allowed on the road because of safety. But Brian in Ballarat says that if a truck is roadworthy, then surely age should not be a factor in its ability to operate. Maybe annual roadworthy tests, which we don't have in Victoria, but we do have in other states, would be more relevant. And also Phil in Sale says the registration costs are already too high and governance costs are also too high. And what would an increased registration cost achieve? A hindrance to business, forcing people back to the horse and cart days. And also one other text there saying that it would hurt mum and dad businesses hardest. So thank you for all of your text there today. Well, that's almost it for the Country Hour. Don't forget the rural website, abc.net.au/rural, and the Facebook page. Just look up ABC Rural. Well, that's all. It's news.